All right, this is CS50, the end of week 9, and this is one of your classmates' homepage. So realize the bar has really been set here. They've submitted what's perhaps the most annoying song I, too, have ever heard, but it now, as usual, is linked on the course's homepage. This is making use of a number of deprecated tags, as the student herself admits, and this really was, it seems, a contest between her and a friend to make the most striking websites possible. So this is linked on the homepage for you all to enjoy as well. But we have some great stuff in store today, starting with graphs. So this is a picture that was actually presented at a TED Talk, one of a famous series of lectures. It's a little grayed out here, but this fellow who gave this particular talk essentially screen scraped like 10,000 Facebook profiles or status updates to see when people's little heart icons were severing and people were breaking up on Facebook. And what he found was that from January through December, it looks like just after Valentine's Day and over spring break is when most of your relationships are bound to end this year. So keep an eye out. February, March of this year. Looks like people tend to stay together around the start of fall semester. Few of you decide to break up around Christmas time, it seems, but this is some interesting data nonetheless. I bring this up, one, because it's just a little fun to look at, but also because in the upcoming problem set eight, well, we actually play with some visualizations. In fact, there's a whole course here in the computer science department, Computer Science 171 Visualizations, which is really about empowering computer scientists and non-computer scientists alike with tools and compelling means of presenting data visually in a way that the masses can actually understand. It's not all that helpful to be looking at thousands of data points generally in an Excel spreadsheet. Just adding a bit of visualization, whether it's the familiar bar charts or something a little more interesting like the Facebook chart or yet others, can really add some pop to one's presentation but also convey a point. So this is Harvard Energy, one of CS50's apps, as I think I've shown before, and this is entirely written on the front end in a language called JavaScript, which we'll begin to look at today. And on the back end, it's implemented with PHP and MySQL. So essentially, once in a while, we synchronize with a big database Harvard has for all of the buildings on campus, greenhouse gas emissions and the electrical use and the water use and so forth. And then we store all of that information in a database, and then we allow people like us to then search and explore that data visually. And we do all of this by generating all of these charts dynamically. There's none of us sitting there with Microsoft Excel or numbers or the like and creating GIFs and JPEGs and then uploading them to the server and changing this every month. It's all completely automated. These web pages written in PHP query a database, ask for just a bunch of numbers, and then output some programming code called JavaScript that then renders these visuals here. So for instance, these are the greenhouse gas equivalents that are emitted by the houses and dorms. Notice here we have a little toolbar that you can drag and drop. And what's neat about this is that all of this is client-side. What you're doing for PSET 7 is pretty much entirely server-side, whereby any changes to the user screen, you're generating server-side, and then the browser is showing the results. Here, the server's not even being contacted. All the data's been downloaded in advance. And so when I click and drag on this little knob here, what's happening is I've written some JavaScript code that also gets downloaded to the user's browser. And this JavaScript code is running all the time, listening and waiting for a human like me to click and drag and interact with the web page. And as soon as it detects such an event, if you recall that jargon from PSET 0 in our Scratch days, it then responds to that event. And so the event I just triggered here was click and drag. And so what you'll find is that as your websites get more interactive, and even after the course they get even more dynamic, you'll find that a lot of programming when it comes to interacting with users is about this event listening model, where you create a lot of mechanisms in your page and your application that's just listening for something to happen, and you write functions or methods, as they're sometimes called, that whose purpose in life is to respond to those human interactions. So there's actually some neat data in here. If you jump to something like Mather House, you can dive in deeper and see more information. If my internet connection here cooperates, come on. Yep, so what you'll see here is that all of these charts, too, were dynamically generated. And one of my favorites is this one down here. This is what the author calls a digraph. It, too, is implemented in JavaScript. And not only is it interactive in that you can hover over these points and immediately see results. I'm not clicking submit. I'm not getting more HTML back from the server. You can even do neat things and zoom in, for instance, on 2004 and see these same data points rendered all the more up close. And what's neat is that it's pretty much instantaneous. And so a lot of the features you're seeing Facebook and Gmail and these other websites rolling out are so immediate in terms of their response because a lot more is being done client-side. And so what we'll do this week is introduce this language called JavaScript so that you too can begin to implement some of these increasingly familiar UI mechanisms so not every one of your websites has to look, you know, dynamic, but nonetheless kind of primitive, like you'll eventually realize that something like CS50 Finance is. So it might all very well be new to you now, but realize that we're just scratching the surface of some of the capabilities of today's web. And we're going to do this with PSET 8 with something called Google Chart Tool. So there's thankfully so much free software and free APIs, application programming interfaces out there, with which we can then and make more interesting applications by not having to implement everything from the ground up ourselves. And so Google, for instance, provides what they call image charts at the top. These are what Tej recall uses for I Saw You Harvard to generate the male-female statistics that you looked at for an earlier PSET. And then these interactive charts, which we'll use for this PSET coming up, are interactive in that they're entirely JavaScript, or in a few cases, Flash-based, but we'll focus on the JavaScript ones, and you can do very neat things. Besides the digraphs we saw, besides the bar charts, you can even do silly things like, where's one of these? Piles of money, whereby you can generate dynamically bigger and bigger piles of money relative to the actual numbers that you provide from your application. And then there's fun ones as well that are certainly common on today's web, like actually being able to embed maps of your own local area or something of interest in your own web page. This stuff is actually relatively easy to do these days thanks to these APIs. So we'll get a taste of that there. Also, a couple of FAQs. So one thing that's been a recurring question is something like this. If I go to, let me go to cloud.cs50.net, tilde CS50, PSET 7. Okay, that doesn't exist. CS50.net, finance. So I'm going to go to the staff's version of CS50 Finance. One of the gotchas a lot of you are running into is that you want to validate your code using the W3C's validator. That's the World Wide Web Consortium. These are just nice volunteers who essentially, over the course of time, craft today's standards for various languages, among them HTML. So some of you have been trying to validate your code. But realize, when we say your code, telephone call, when you say your code must be valid, this means not your PHP code per se, but the HTML that it generates. So if you found yourself copying and pasting your raw PHP files code into the W3C's validator, that's not what you should actually be doing. In fact, you're pretty much telling those nice volunteers all of the good or bad code that you've been writing by doing so. Rather, what you should be doing is visiting your web page with a browser and then going to, say, whichever menu is appropriate, the view menu or such, and going to view page source, and only copying and pasting the output. Because when we talk about the validity of HTML, we really mean the client-side stuff that hits the actual browser, where it's important for it to be really right so that various browsers all display it differently. But there is a gotcha. So CS50 Finance obviously requires authentication. And so you can't just paste the URLs of your web pages into the validator site because obviously they, like a human, will be redirected to login.php. So they can't see all of your HTML. But realize one of the tools that we recommended for this problem set is something called a Web Developer Toolbar. It's a free download for Firefox. And what it adds to your browser is this little menu here, things like resize, things like miscellaneous, tools, and the like. And under tools, you'll see a few options. One of them is validate local HTML. What's really nice here is that you can log into CS50 Finance, visit any of your pages, and then just go to Tools, Validate Local HTML, and the plugin will automate the process of copying and pasting all of your code into the validator site so you don't have to jump through these hoops yourself. It's a wonderfully useful development tool. And those of you thinking about final projects and entrepreneurial projects down the road, realize that even simple things like this are hugely useful these days. The resize tool here is just a little plugin that will immediately resize your browser to be a specific size. And this is useful so that if you are one of these people who has a 30-inch monitor, it's not that great to design a website with 30-inch monitor users in mind because most people don't have monitors this large. And so the page, they're going to have to scroll horizontally, vertically. It's going to be a real mess. So generally, when I develop some web application, I resize the window to some fixed size, like 1024 by 768 pixels across and down. And that happens to still be sort of the lowest common denominator, at least with modern computers, though thankfully our screens are getting bigger and bigger. So realize there's some wonderfully useful tools to take the tedium out of some of these processes. All right, so other common things that folks are encountering. Well, how about messages like this? So no joke, this happened to me this morning, and there's nothing more infuriating when you don't know like what you're supposed to do for the day when you visit Google Calendar and you're told Google Calendar is not found. So this code 404 is something that's not uncommon on the web, either because a page has been deleted or the user made a mistake. 404 is the arcane number that's been assigned to the concept file does not exist or URL is invalid. In short, whatever URL you tried to visit, in this case Google Calendar this morning, someone accidentally deleted Google Calendar, it seems, and the file was not found, index.php or index.html or whatever language they happen to be using. Now, this is presumably some other weird configuration error, since probably no one deleted Google Calendar, but other popular mistakes that some of you might be seeing in your own code or others are these. So 401 refers to unauthorized. If you ever visit a page that's supposed to be password protected in some way and you've not provided the right username and password, you'll often see this arcane code. 403, forbidden. This usually has to relate to a chmod error on your part, at least in our context of web development. You've not chmodded a GIF file or a ping 644 or a directory 711. And again, you'll get custom to these arcane numbers over time, but just refer back to PSET 7 spec for what commands to write to fix those. And 500 is generally pretty bad. That means there's some non-trivial problem wrong in the code that drives the page you're trying to visit, but realize there are dozens of other codes that relate to status messages. These are just some of the most popular. And two more FAQs, if I may. So you'll see in the spec for the problem set, or rather the distribution code for the problem set, that we make use of things like post or get, but also we make use of something called session. So $_session is another super global in PHP whose purpose in life is really just to be some storage space for any data you want to put in there. You can put any key value pairs, and in PSET 7, what do we in the distro code use session for? The cached ID, yeah. So once the user logs in, they have a user ID, UID field, which is just a number. And so if you looked at the login code that we gave to you, you'll see that with just one line of code, we're doing something that looks like this. $_session, quote unquote, UID equals 123, where 123 is actually a variable in the code that happens to be the current user's user ID. What's really nice about this session super global is that even though HTTP is what we've called a stateless protocol, whereby you visit a page, little icon spins around saying downloading page, and then the icon stops because the page has been downloaded, thereby severing the connection between browser and server. Well, this session super global is really neat because what happens is the next time the user visits a web page, they are their identity is inferred just based on the web server having seen that user before, and me, the programmer, am handed this same super global and the same contents for that particular user. So even though the protocol is stateless, I disconnect from the server every time I'm finished downloading a web page, the session super global creates the illusion for me, the programmer, that I can still store information for this specific user. And so even though in my code I'm only ever saying $_session, I essentially get a unique copy of this super global for every one of my unique users on the internet. So this begs the question, how in the world is the server handing me the right session super global for a given user? How does PHP, how does the web server remember to which user each of these copies of session actually belongs? Yeah, so in fact, it is cookies, right? So recall our discussion last week of FireSheep, all this freaking out that people are having over FireSheep and session hijacking. When we say session hijacking, there is the session that's being hijacked in the context of PHP. It's called different things in different languages, but in the context of PHP, this is just a super global. And so if any of your friends have maliciously logged into your Facebook or other account, what's happening is the web server, Facebook.com, is presenting to that user the contents of your super global. And so because your user ID is in there, because maybe your friends lists and stuff like that is in there, though that's not necessarily the case, that's how the user, your friend, is able to see everything that you are actually seeing. And so how is this thing ultimately implemented? Yes, with cookies. So when you're requesting a web page and that cookie is going back and forth across the wire that we discussed last week, that hand stamp, so to speak, that cookie, that big random number, is the only thing via which this abstraction, this super for global is actually implemented. But that's all that it boils down to. But you'll notice, and this probably will happen to Facebook in due time, even we on the course's homepage started doing this literally after that lecture, you'll find that everything about CS50 now runs over SSL, https://, and we also reconfigured the server to make sure that anytime we send a session cookie to a user, a big random number, we will only send that session cookie if it's over HTTPS. So if you've read in the media that some sites kind of use SSL, but not entirely, generally they are only kind of using SSL because they're misconfigured or they're foolishly configured in such a way that if you manually visit, say, cs50.net and hit enter, because you're not explicitly saying HTTPS, a foolish server would say, oh, here's the cookie you wanted me to remember. And in that sense, session can be hijacked because it's not going to be encrypted until I get bounced to the HTTPS-based URL. So in short, all of the things you've been reading about or worrying about on campus are really reduced to a very simple variable, at least if the website's written in PHP, called $_session. Lastly, one other trick, just to plant the idea in your head. A lot of you are doing things like this, $SQL for SQL, which is just a variable name here. You might do something like this, select star from users. Let's just come up with a quick query. But suppose you want to get a specific user, so you're probably not just getting star from users, you're getting star from users where user ID equals 123. But unfortunately, you're not just writing 123 in your code. The user's ID is, of course, in a variable. In fact, it's in this variable here. So a lot of you are running into the gotcha where you very reasonably paste that right into the string, thinking, all right, well, this is just a variable. So much like in PHP's examples we've seen before, $_session, quote unquote, UID, will just get turned to 123. But frankly, because of the double quotes that are inside there, these things here, because of the square brackets, PHP just gets confused by this syntax. So there's two solutions. This is not the right way to do it. You will get some kind of parse error, some kind of read error. A right way to do this would be to just put that super global variable inside of curly braces, which says, here's something special. Don't get confused by the weird syntax inside. Or you can use that concatenation operator we saw the other day, which would allow us to do something like equals quote dot, and then you can concatenate in this variable like this. So both of these latter two examples has the end result of creating one string that represents a SQL query, and you avoid this parse error that a lot of you are running into. Yes? It is a design decision that the authors of PHP made in that this is ambiguous. Now that we have double quotes inside of double quotes and we have square braces here, they just made the design decision that this could be ambiguous. We don't want to misinterpret this phrase. And so we will require that PHP programmers use curly braces to avoid this ambiguity. For simpler variables, if the variable is simply $X, it is perfectly OK and arguably much more readable just to say this. That is OK because there's no weird syntax there. There's no ambiguity. There's no risk of misinterpretation. So it was just a design decision. And lastly, a reference that can be very helpful. We point you to this in the specification quite often throughout the PDF, but realize that PHP.net is one of the reasons that we use PHP as the language of choice toward the end of the semester, because it's so relatively easy to teach yourself based on examples and based on documentation. And frankly, of all the languages I've ever learned or taught myself, PHP's documentation is probably the best, even better than Java's Java Talk, because it's rich with many more examples. For instance, if I forget how PHP's date function works, almost always can you Google it. You'll find a link leading you to php.net. And every one of these pages follows a standard format. You'll see the name of the function here. You'll see the version of PHP that supports this, which is only relevant if you're maybe developing a website on an older server. This is the prototype for the function. Even though PHP doesn't require that you specify data types, the language itself knows that there are different data types. So the documentation makes clear what those data types are. You get a list of all of the parameters and the format strings and such, much like you would in a man page. But the most compelling thing, and the thing I frankly almost always jump to first, is that you almost always get one or more examples, where just a real person has written a very common example with instructions and with comments, and you can just learn, frankly, by a lot of examples. So don't underestimate the value of this particular resource. So with those building blocks, what can you start to do? Well, realize the web is getting much more interesting, and we've introduced this idea of HTML5, which hasn't actually been finalized as a standard, but the world is really clamoring to implement some new and fancy features into the HTML language so that we can move away from using proprietary software like Adobe Flash, which requires that the user manually download some additional software and the like, requires that they program in a different language. And so HTML5, one of its goals is to make the web even more dynamic, and so realize with this last problem set in these last couple of weeks, will we begin to scratch the surface of, frankly, what the web will probably be and remain for a couple of years. This is, for instance, some of the new capabilities of video in HTML5. So this is, I think, the trailer for a movie called Tron, or a remake thereof. But what's neat is that built into the language is this ability, built into HTML, is the ability with code on the client side to just do things like this, arbitrarily crop out some part of it, change the perspective on the fly without having to download special software with which to do all of that. You can do things like transitions much more easily, which up until now have required plugins like Adobe Flash. Now realize, much like with PowerPoint, these things can be very quickly abused. I'm not sure I would get into the habit of making my web page do this all the time. It's very easy to annoy users, but you can do really cool things. This is one that TF's just discovered, or just introduced me to. This is a chat room implemented entirely with JavaScript. This is not what you think it is, but there is an explanation for this. It's a little chat room, so I'm going to change my name to, let's say, Sanders. Oh, here comes a TF. And it's a virtual chat room where I can then say, hey, Rose. And we can all meet. Oh, and there's Thomas. Hello, Thomas. And guest 8743. Now, just in my defense, what is this site? Oh, a lot of you are now in here. apparently, this is a Rumpet Troll, which is the name of the website, which translates to tadpole, but apparently more literally to ass troll. So we're not really all that far away. But this is all done. What's cool is this is JavaScript, right? So maybe I shouldn't leave this up here so long. That's great. We're talking to people on the internet. All right. This could get bad quickly. So let's close that. So frankly, this is really quite cool because up until now, you would have to write programs like this in languages like Java or in ActionScript. And that's not to say that's a bad thing, but it requires, again, that the user have special software, namely the Java runtime environment or the Flash plugin. And then you have to actually use multiple languages just to implement your website. So what's compelling about HTML5, among other things, is the move toward, ideally, some more open standards, which generally does tend to be a good thing for the world and certainly for people who want to program in it. One other one that I thought I'd demo at a TF's request. This one isn't so misinterpretable. This is a Macintosh that's fallen asleep. Here we go. Give it a moment to wake up. So we commented to each other that this is perhaps more impressive to people like us who know what JavaScript used to not be able to do. But even though the fidelity on the screen here is not so great, all of this is not a downloadable program. This is not a Flash plugin. This is pure JavaScript code that's moving these little fish around in this 3D environment. So this is where we're getting to. You can really do some neat things. In fact, one of the CS50 seminars will talk about web programming. It'll be led by Phil, one of our teaching fellows, who's particularly into these kinds of animations, these kinds of technologies. In fact, during Quiz Zero, he called me over while proctoring quite excitedly because one of the projects Phil had been working on was this new software on his own Mac, and like many Macs these days, it has a little eyesight camera built in. And what he did was he wrote code running on his own Mac that had an image on the screen, and if he moved his body or face to the left, the image on the screen would then look at him this way. And if he moved over here, the computer would then look at him this way. And this is just by using this built-in hardware that, you know, statistically half of you already have. So final projects are really a fun chance to put some of these things to the test. So it's all about ultimately having the right tools And so here's one example of what you can do with the right tools. So many of you had a great time battling with hash tables or tries or the like for problem set 6. This was, of course, to implement the dictionary. And you'll realize that you'll recall that there's a lot of low-level details there. There's a lot of chance for error with pointers. There's a lot of conceptual complexity, at least toward wrapping your mind around the problem at first. But realize once you have multiple tools in your toolkit, multiple languages, multiple mental models, can you start to pick from among them and use the right tool for the job? So case in point, one of the neat things about PHP and a lot of languages like it is how much you just get for free out of the box. There are so many more functions, for better or for worse, built into PHP, the mail function, for instance, or these MySQL functions. And the upside is that it's just much easier to do some common tasks. So suppose I wanted to implement that spell checker in PHP, not to disappoint after all the hard work you put in, but if I wanted to implement a PHP function for load, and it's got to take a variable, namely the path to the dictionary, its function declaration might look like this. It's pretty much like C, except we now have no mention of data types, and we have a dollar sign. But for the most part, this is the same declaration. Well, it turns out in PHP, if I wanted to implement the load function, I could do for file dict as word hash table word gets true. Done. That is the load function when written in PHP. So minor white lie, because I've not actually integrated any kind of error checking. So just to contextualize this, I actually need this hash table, right? So how do I declare a hash table in PHP? Done. All right, so that's my hash table, right? It's called an array here, but the array function in PHP returns an array. But what type of array does it actually return? An associative array. And an associative array is just the formal incarnation of a hash table, or rather an associative array, a map between keys and values, can be implemented by what we now know and have implemented ourselves as an underlying hash table using separate chaining or linear probing or whatever technique you happen to choose. Now it reduces in higher level languages to a simple command like this. As for the check function. Let's see, the check function, I think, looked a little something like this, and I need to return true or false. So I can just say if hash table word, I can then say return true, else return false. Done. There's my spell checker, right? And think about how this is working. If the load function has indexed into this hash table array at word, so word might be apple or banana or peach or pear, whatever the words were in the dictionary, each of those fruits is a key, and each of them has a value, and the value I somewhat arbitrarily but somewhat intelligently chose was true. Because later, I don't care really where this thing is in the array, I just want an instant answer saying yes or no, true or false, this word has been put into this hash table, into this associative array. So later on, it suffices to say if the hash table's value at the current word's location exists, is non-false, it must be the case that I put it there, and so I get back an answer of true. Otherwise, I return an answer of false. Now, of course, the goal of a hash table, as we discussed it, was to really whittle things down to constant time. Realistically, you're not going to get truly constant time. But what's nice is that now the language, the runtime environment, like PHP, can start to make some of those hard design decisions for us and save me, frankly, a huge amount of time. So again, development time, the computer scientist's time, is certainly one of the limited resources that's got to be taken into account when solving some problem. But there is a trade-off. I'm going to go ahead now and run the staff solution, which is in CS50, pub, solutions, pset 6, speller. And I'll go ahead and run it on, let's say, one of the larger files, the King James Bible. Enter. So those are all the words that were misspelled. And it looks like it took the staff solution 0.42 seconds to spell check that file. So you have among your printouts for Monday this file here, speller.c. Speller.php. Just speller. So the name of this file is just speller. And if you read through this code, which I would recommend doing, if only so that you see, you can learn by example how to write in PHP code that you've already seen in C. Pretty much I sat down one night and took the C version of speller, which was in PSET6's distro code, and I just rewrote it line by line to PHP. And because PHP syntactically is very much like C, it's almost a line for line translation. It's a little easier, in fact, to do some things. But then I also also sat down to implement the dictionary. So in dictionary.php, you see more comments. You essentially see a few subtleties that I have to add to these functions, but not many more lines of code. I just added some error checking. So in short, in these two files, we now have a re-implementation in PHP of the entirety of problem set 6. And now let me go ahead and run this one. Speller, the PHP version on the King James Bible. Enter. So it's not a longer list of words. What's really happening here? It's actually just a slower list of words, all right? And now you'll realize that was actually a little more, felt like more than 1.92 seconds. That's because it takes some time to actually spit this many characters onto the screen, download them from the network, show them on a laptop. But in any case, real time in terms of CPU seconds, my PHP version took 1.92 seconds, whereas recall if I run the staff's C-based solution, 0.42 seconds. And this doesn't have to do with load on the cloud, people using it at this moment. This just has to do with the language. So here's one of the trade-offs. We've introduced PHP, but this is an interpreted language. We skip the compilation step. Now, that's great because when you're developing projects, you just have to reload your browser. Bam, you see the results. There's no compiling. There's no linking, no assembling. There's no low-level steps. You are freer to just change something, view the results. Change something, view the results. But the downside, of course, is that at some point, what you write as PHP code, which is not really zeros and ones, it's not really English, it's a programming language, at some point, that programming code has to be translated in some form to something a machine, a CPU actually understands. And so when you run PHP code, you're actually running it through something called an interpreter. So on this Linux system, on my Mac, and even on a Windows computer, if you install it, there is a program called PHP. In Windows, it'd be called php.exe. And ironically, it's probably written in C itself. But its purpose in life is to read PHP-based files, top to bottom, left to right, and then essentially figure out what to do at each line based on the code that it encounters. But this translation, this interpretation process, simply takes some additional time. So there's overhead. So if you are trying to implement the fastest spell checker possible, and by fastest I mean runtime, not developer time, you know, we made the right decision with C. If you're actually processing millions of words, billions of words, if you're implementing Facebook or Google, or really just any real-world program, even if they're not as massive as those sites, you do probably do want to stick with something like C or C++ or one of these lower-level languages because you can really squeeze your money's worth and your cycle's worth out of that hardware. But if that's less of a concern, if you only have to deal with, you know, a few dozen users per second on the web server, you can spend these CPU cycles, have slower code, but my God, it was so much easier to implement this, and my code is no less correct. So that is PHP's version of Speller, and notice one trick here too. At the very top of this PHP file, notice I have this special funky sequence of characters, sharp, bang, slash, user, slash, bin, slash, PHP. This is what's generally known as a shebang, for sharp, bang. And this is simply a line that says what program should be used to interpret this file. So it turns out there's many different languages you can write these days, Perl and PHP and Python and Ruby and Bash and Tish and many, many, many others. And you can simply tell the computer which of these various languages interpreters do you want to use to run this program. So I have consciously written this program in PHP, hence the open bracket question mark at the top and the opposite at the bottom. But I need to tell the computer what program to use to run this code. Or if I did not have that shebang, I could simply run the PHP program and say run the program called Speller and hit enter. And much like command line arguments usually work, that would pass my code in the file called Speller into PHP. But in the context of the web, we obviously have a web server involved, and its purpose in life is to realize, oh, you're requesting a URL that ends in .php. I will jump through these hoops for you, invoke the interpreter, pass your code through it, and only spit out the results to you. So that's what the web server has been doing for us. But realize when it comes time after this class for your own research or projects or whatnot, if you ever want to write a command line program, you're probably not going to want to reach for C. If really you just want to get the job done quickly, you want to pick a language like PHP or something higher level that just gives you many more tools for free so that, bam, 1 minute later, you know, my PSET or my research project's busy work is done. So with that said, we now have time for another interpreted language. So in the context of a web page. You obviously have tags. And we've seen tags like HTML tag, body tag, head tag, title tag, div tag, and a bunch of others. But it turns out there's one other that's a little special called the script tag in that it tells the browser, hey, browser, here comes a program. Here comes a script. This is really just an issue of semantics, really. But script is essentially a synonym for program. But a script is usually a program written in an interpreted language. And that language here is going to be JavaScript. So these days, JavaScript is a language that browsers understand. You don't need to download special software. Any modern browser knows how to read and interpret and execute a program or a script written in this language called JavaScript. Now, JavaScript for some time was generally relegated to doing really stupid things on the web. If you think maybe five or six years ago, the world was plagued by pop-ups and advertisements that would pop up in Windows. You'd visit some sketchy website, and you couldn't close said sketchy website because every time you would, a new page would open. Well, that's thanks to a programming language that was essentially listening for the event called close page. And the moment it heard that event, what was it clearly doing? Open page, right? So this gets very annoying quickly, but it all reduces, frankly, to the same building blocks we'll introduce today. But what's really powerful about JavaScript is not nuisances like that, but that now you can really interact with the user on the client side. So any of these applications we've been using this year, even the one you might have used earlier in the term, courses.cs50.net, there is a backend to this website. There is PHP code. There is a MySQL database. But anytime you click one of these little plus signs and instantaneously see that course's description, you didn't have time to make a request to the website, get back a miniature web page, and then show it to you here. It's instantaneous because we've pre-downloaded all of this data and we're showing it to you on demand. And so if you hover over Q guide scores and immediately see them, that's simply because we already had the data. We just now need to write a program, a script, not in PHP, which is way far away now. It's on the server in a language called JavaScript that's listening for these events. And these events can now trigger responses like show Q guide scores or show the like. And frankly, if you are a fanatic on Facebook and you see your news feed and all of these new features where things are changing dynamically and you can click on icons and little menus pop up, this is all thanks to a language called JavaScript. So why don't we go ahead and take our 5-minute break. All right, so we are back, and we left off with this cliffhanger here. There is a script tag, and this says, hey, browser, here comes a script written in most generally a language called JavaScript. So what does this language actually do, and what can we actually do with it? So I'm going to go ahead and open up a file called form1.html. This is among Monday's printouts. And it looks a little something like this. There's not much code in here at all. In fact, even based on our limited experience with HTML, you can probably figure out what this thing is doing. It's got a body with a form inside of it. That form's action is dump.php, which is just a little quick and dirty script I wrote to just dump the contents of what's submitted by this form. I'm going to use the get method here. I've got an email field of type text, a password field of type password, another password field of type password, and then a checkbox of sorts. So this is sort of a prototypical form on the web that's asking you to interact with it in a few different ways, and it looks a little something like this. Let me go into the source, pull up forms1.html, and I definitely didn't put much time into the aesthetics, just the functionality. Now, unfortunately, this form is not that very robust. I can say nope and just type in some random password, the wrong password again, not even bother checking the form, click submit. And it does, in fact, submit. And notice this is what I happen to type in. So dump.php, you have a function called dump in pset 7 that just is meant to facilitate debugging like this. I'm seeing apparently the contents of what superglobal? So get, right? So if the form is using method equals quote unquote get, the superglobal that's going to contain all these key value pairs is not post, which we consciously use throughout pset 7 so that you wouldn't be passing around financial information and usernames and passwords. I'm just using get here. So I have just printed out the contents of $_get. How did I do this? Well, if you've looked at the distribution code, you'll see that your own dump function just does something terribly simple like this. In HTML, there's a pre tag, which stands for pre-formatted text. which means even though browsers generally ignore white space, they only want you to use things like the br tag for line breaks. Well, if you say pre in a tag, this will now say show every little space, every little character literally. Don't throw anything away. And there's this other function which is useful for diagnostic purposes in PHP called print underscore r, print recursive. This takes in a variable, and if it's got some kind of hierarchy to it, like a hash table would, like a super global, like get would, it's going to show me everything. And it just shows it in this arbitrary format that's just very user-friendly to read. So it's a nice trick for debugging just to see what's going on inside this thing. Unfortunately, there's no form of validation on this form. And certainly on websites today, you get yelled at if you try to register for a site with an invalid username or password, if you try to log in with the wrong one, if you provide a word when you're being asked for a number, if you fail to check a box, in short, recurring theme on the internet. Now, you can certainly do server-side error checking, and those of you who have dived into PSET 7 know that you have to do this. If you ask the user, how many shares do you want to buy, and they type hello, well, you don't want to buy some indeterminate number of shares based on that input. You want to check. This is obviously not a number. This is a word. You need to apologize to the user or you reprimand them for not providing the right input. But what's a downside of doing this kind of validation on the server side in your PHP code, perhaps? Takes longer, right? Even though the web's pretty quick on a decent internet connection, you know, we've seen it take 20 milliseconds to get from one router to another. It generally takes less than 1 second, so generally less than 2 seconds for client to talk to server. You know, that's still a bit of latency. Latency is delayed, especially perceptible delay that the user notices. So it'd be nice if we realized that the user's typed in something bogus. Why don't I tell them right away? Well, HTML and CSS are just about markup and aesthetics. There's no logical features built into those languages. But with a real programming language like JavaScript, can we actually look at the values the user's typed in the browser, and without troubling the server, I can immediately check, wait a minute, those passwords aren't the same. Wait a minute, that's not a number. Now, I can't do things like, wait a minute, that username's already taken, because the only way I would know that answer is asking the server if the username is taken. But for many, many, many types of questions, can I just answer this by writing code that runs in the browser and answers these questions for me? So my goal here with form1.html was just to demonstrate a form that does no such validation. Now let's start to use this programming language JavaScript to create a more pleasurable experience for the user, more interactive experience, whereby you don't have to sit there waiting for the server to be contacted every time you have some trivial question. And so we now have this here. This is form2.html, and notice at the bottom of this file, which printout you do have from Monday, it's pretty much the same thing, but there are a couple slight differences. Notice I've taken it upon myself to give this form tag a name, and that's because I want to be able to refer to it later in my programming code. Much like you can give variables names, so can you give tags, or more specifically elements in a web page, specific names so that you can reference those tags specifically and not some other form in the page. And I've also added this. It's wrapping, so it looks a little ugly here because the font's a little big, but if I just add some temporary white space, turns out there is another attribute we've not used yet called onSubmit that frankly does what the name says. When this form is submitted, the following code is going to get executed. So just like with the style tag, you can put that language called CSS for font sizes and colors and aesthetic stuff like that. With the onSubmit attribute inside of its quotes, you can actually put programming code, specifically JavaScript code. You don't have to write out full functions. You can just write single statements. Think back to Scratch. A single puzzle piece is a statement. Well, here too, can we just put a single statement in between quotes with a semicolon at the end? And it looks like the function I'm calling here is a function called validate. Because I read the manual, and it tells me the onSubmit attribute takes a value that should be a function, and that function should return true or false. If it returns true, the form will be submitted as usual. If it returns false, the form is not going to be submitted. This is great, because this means now I can not trouble the server. I can short circuit a form submission if the user's done something stupid, like not answer my questions properly. So how do I do this? Well, what is this validate function? It's not built into JavaScript. I had to write it myself. So let me scroll back up in this file. It's not terribly long, just a lot of white space. And here's the very top of the file. I've got my doc type, my HTML tag, my head tag. And now notice for the first time, inside of the head of the web page, I have this script tag. Now, as an aside, the script tag can go elsewhere in the page. There's sometimes downsides of putting it elsewhere. So if you can, it's good to put it in the script in the head. But sometimes there's problems putting it there. So we'll see by example if and when we want to put it elsewhere. But the script tag says the language I'm going to use is text/JavaScript. This is a thing called a MIME type, which is just a unique string that some volunteers have decided is the special string that identifies this language called JavaScript. If your users happen to be using Internet Explorer or a sort of specialized browser, you can use other languages, VBScript, for instance, in the Windows world. But these days, if you're writing a site that's not meant to be tied to one browser, it's supposed to be universal, pretty much the language you've got available to you is JavaScript. So, and that's not a bad thing. It's quite powerful and rich these days. Now, this is just a stupid syntactic detail here. This is one of these things that will take forever to remember, so I've copied and pasted it almost always. // is a comment, /bang, bracket, cdata, bracket. It's a stupid, unique string that just says to the browser, what's following is called character data, not parsed character data. And this just means if you see things like open brackets or ampersands, don't freak out. They have nothing to do with HTML. They have to do with math, like the less than sign. The ampersand has to do with a Boolean value or something like this. So this sequence of syntax, which you won't see in every book, this is generally good to do just so that your code works on all browsers. This just says to the browser, again, don't get confused if you see some scary HTML-like syntax. This is actually programming code. Now, what is that programming code? Here's how you implement a function in JavaScript. It's not unlike PHP. JavaScript, like PHP, is loosely typed. Even though there is the notion of different data types, you, the programmer, don't all have to get into the business of declaring them specifically. You can just infer from context. So I say function validate open paren, close paren, which means there's no arguments to this function. And now these lines are a little long as it is. I went with the simple but verbose approach because we can kind of infer from each line of code what's going on. So here's an if condition, here's an else if, and then a return. The syntax, realize it's almost like PHP. It's almost like C. I mean, it's deliberate that we've chosen such similar syntactically languages. So what am I asking? If document.forms.registration.email.value ... quote unquote. So that's pretty verbose. There are cleaner ways of doing this, but let's reinterpret it literally. Document is a special global value, a global object, as it's called, that you're handed when you're writing JavaScript code in the confines of a web page, and this gives you access to all the interesting stuff in the web page, namely the forms. So document.forms, notice the syntax is pretty much what we used for structs in C when they're not pointers. We use the dot notation. So document.forms, turns out, is essentially an object, so just kind of some structure in memory, a struct, containing all of the forms on this specific page. Now, how do I get the form I actually care about? Well, thankfully, I gave it a name. So document.forms.registration returns to me essentially the chunk of memory that is representing the form that we implemented in HTML. So this is what's neat about JavaScript. Whereas HTML is ultimately about the structure and the aesthetics of your website, JavaScript now allows you to view your web page as some in-memory data structure, like those we played with problem set 5 and problem set 6. So in fact, just to paint this picture here, let me pull up this snippet of arbitrary HTML. This is a very simple web page. It's got the doc type up top, a HTML, head, title, body tag, a random link, and then an H1 tag. I just needed something to play with. But notice that I've deliberately indented things, being nice and pretty printed. But notice, too, that this indentation really does imply a structure to this web page. HTML, that tag, open bracket HTML, seems to be the most important tag. Doc type aside, ignore the first line. HTML seems to be the most important because inside of that tag is everything else. And then inside of the head tag is something else. Inside of the body tag is something else. So we kind of have a structure here whereby the HTML tag or element is really the root of something. It seems to have two children, the head child and the body child. And each of those things also has children. So it seems to be a data structure much like we looked at 2 weeks ago, so I can draw this like this. All right, you can draw this any number of ways, but I'm going to come up with an arbitrary thing at the top here. I'm just going to say I need a node, a super root node called the document node. The very first thing in this page is what's generally called in industry the root element. And notice that I've deliberately drawn a head tag as a child, a body tag as a child. The head tag, meanwhile, has a title child, and the title tag kind of does have a child because there is something inside of it, even though it's not another tag. So I'll hang that off of this node as though it's another child, albeit a textual child. And then I'll do the same thing for the body tag over here. And over here, with the attribute, I don't really want to hang the attribute, the href attribute, off vertically because it feels like that's definitely not a child because it can't itself have children. So arbitrarily, but reasonably, I'm going to hang off this node anchor laterally to the side the href attribute. So in short, I can draw an HTML page as a tree. And this tree is generally known as something called a DOM, a document object model. So what's neat now is that now that we have the ability to create web pages and structure them with HTML, you can now start thinking about them really as from a computer scientist's perspective. I'm really just building a tree using these tags, but this nesting is implying a hierarchy. So now that I have a language called JavaScript, can I actually traverse this tree in memory by going from root to child to child to child? So what we're really seeing here syntactically, document.forms.registration.email, is kind of like the process of starting at the top of this tree and stepping through it, traversing, trying to get down to the thing I care about. So what do I really care about? The document's forms object, registration object, its email field, and specifically the value of that email field. So what that's really going to do for me, if we scroll back down, here is the very simple input tag that we have here. And notice it's got a name of email. And notice it's got a type. But once the user actually types something into that field, then it has a value. So with this JavaScript code up here and this familiar branching structure, I'm just asking the question, if the email's value is blank, yell at the user. And how do I yell at them? In JavaScript, there's a built-in, if slightly annoying and aesthetically ugly, function called alert that takes a string as its argument, and that string is what the user sees in a little pop-up. And then I return false. Why? Why is validate returning false? Right, because I want to make sure that the form does not now get submitted. So if I return false, that value inside of the onSubmit handler will return false, which means the browser will say, oh, the user, the programmer canceled the submission of this form. But there's some other things the user can do to be difficult. If the password one field equals equals quote unquote, that is if it's blank, I'm going to yell at the user, you must provide a password. If by contrast, password one's value does not equal password two's value, you must provide the same password twice, will be my admonishment. And then lastly, if it is not, so notice the bang, if not document.forms.registration.agreement.checked, I want to yell at the user that he or she must agree to our terms and conditions. So it turns out that just as form fields, just as elements in a web page can have a value, a textual value like the username or the password, there are special elements in a web page like a checkbox that also have properties, but not textual values. They have Boolean properties like checked. So .checked, as applied to agreement, is just a Boolean value that tells you, the programmer, is that checkbox checked or not? And so now you have the ability programmatically to check these answers without actually looking in the super global called get or post. You can do this all on the client side. So the end result is that the user's interaction now looks like this. If I go to form2.html, the thing looks the same, but if I am completely difficult and don't type anything in and click submit, now I get this alert that says you must provide an email address. Now, I kind of criticize this thing as ugly because, frankly, every browser makes this window look differently, and this is kind of a stupid way of starting it. The page at such and such a URL says they all look different, so the world tends not to use the alert function, but it is a quick and dirty way of at least providing feedback, so we'll start off with that for now. But we can do a bit better, or at least a bit differently. So notice this, too. Notice I've rewritten the validate function in this version of my code as actually taking an argument, just to provide you with this trick as we'll see it moving forward. So this takes an argument called f, and it looks like f just represents what? The form itself. So I seem to be calling the validate function not with an open paren, close paren, with no arguments. I seem to be passing in the form itself as an argument. So how do you pass a node? How do you pass a structure in a tree as an argument? Well, let's look at how my HTML changed. It's not all that different, but notice on the top right, this time with onSubmit, I'm returning validate of this. Now, those of you who took AP Computer Science or some background course before 50 know about Java, most likely, and you know about the special keyword this. This is a self-referential variable that refers to whatever the thing in context currently is. So because I say this inside of double quotes, and those double quotes are inside of these angled brackets, and the tag in question is form, when I say quote, when I say this, I mean this form. So now I have the ability with JavaScript to also pass around nodes in my tree, little rectangles like this, as though they really are in-memory objects, just like we had in C. If I look at the fourth variant of this, notice what I can do now. Let me show you what the HTML actually looks like here. And I'm going to go to form4.html. And now notice, I cannot even click this button. So now I can really be kind of a defensive against the annoying user. And now I can require that they type in, let's say, a legit email address, type in a password. I'll use my favorite. And now notice, only when I check this box, watch what happens at bottom left, does the submit button become enabled. So you might have seen this on a website, but this just boils down to some simple weak zero Boolean properties. So let's look at this code. In form 4, notice now that I have this in my HTML. I still have the onSubmit handler, but notice this one. Again, it's wrapping because my font's a little large today. But let's look at this. If I move some white space in there, notice that there's another event handler. OnSubmit obviously does the following when the form's submitted. Well, for other things, you don't submit a checkbox. You submit a form, but you do click a checkbox, as you do certain other parts of web pages. So it turns out that this event handler, called onClick, also takes one or more statements separated by semicolons. And this one's purpose is to call a function when this DOM element, this DOM node, is clicked. So what is toggle? Toggle is a function I wrote that uses another property that I read about in the documentation, and it does this. If document.forms.registration.button, wait a minute, what's button? Well, notice I gave this thing a name. If I scroll back down, notice this time I gave this input type, which is type equals submit. Notice I gave it a name, button, because I need to be able to access this button, this submit button, so I can turn it on and turn it off to enable and disable it. So here's toggle. If document.forms.registration.button.disabled is true, so here's yet another property. So this is what's really neat. Even though we've just been writing HTML for structural and aesthetic reasons, all of these tags we write do get interpreted by the browser. And every time the browser encounters a new tag, it essentially calls the equivalent of malloc, mallocing enough memory for that node that then represents that tag inside of RAM. And it associates with some of those nodes certain properties based on their type, this one being a submit button. And so that submit button has a special property called disabled. And if that is true, then obviously the button is disabled. You cannot click it. So what I'm doing here is, if the button's disabled, make that not so. Like, make that false. Else, if it is not disabled, make that true. Do disable it. So it toggles the state of this variable by using just another event handler. And my validate function is identical. Now, how did I actually do this down here? It's worth noting this, because this is kind of a stupid reality of modern web programming. Input disabled equals disabled. So this is a paradigm you actually see. Back in the day with HTML 1 and 2 and earlier versions, you could have attributes in a tag that did not have an equal sign or quotes. This is largely frowned upon these days. So the world realized, wow, we still want to have the ability to disable an element, but we need some value. Now, a reasonable person might have said something like true or 1 or something, but they decided, let's not come up with yet another value. Let's just say value equals itself. And so you'll see this throughout the literature. But that just means, by default, this button is disabled. Notice if I get rid of that and then resave this page and reload the browser, notice that this page is no longer, is it saving properly? Whoops. Why? Oh, I think I'm changing the wrong version. So if I were actually visiting the right version of this file with this particular browser, you'd see that the submit button is actually working. But you know what? I can cheat and save myself here for some definition of save. I'm going to go to inspect element. Notice this is our friend Firebug. And what's really nice, if you'd like to geek out with this stuff, notice I will just manually go in here. Come on. Change that. There we go. So this actually illustrates a point. So let's assume that was deliberate, that mistake I made. So this actually illustrates a point, which is that you might be really excited that, wow, I don't have to write all this damn PHP code, which has been confusing me the past couple of days. I can just start embedding this on the client side. And the upside, too, is that the user gets a better, faster experience. But unfortunately, if the user has a modicum of technical savvy or has free software installed, any of these client-side defenses can be completely circumvented. Clearly, did I just disable the disabling of the button just by tweaking the code? You know already from PSET 7, you can pretend to be a browser and request things like Yahoo's web page, but doing it from a PHP context. So you have to realize that with form validation or any client-side code, you cannot trust that the user will execute that code as you wrote it. You have to assume that they're still going to try to insert bad stuff into your website, and so still these server-side protections that we've been preaching for problem set 7 remain a necessity. So unfortunately, you have to do both. The upside of one is a better user better user experience. The upside of the other is that your website remains safer. So let's take a look at now one other capability of JavaScript. So back in the just a few years ago, frankly, JavaScript was a pretty annoying language. It created all these pop-ups in the world. It would have these ugly little alert messages on a website. But now that you can really program against the DOM of a web page and do increasingly powerful things, you can create much better user interfaces. For instance, the one I always turn to, only because it was one of the first sites to do this. The fact that you can click and drag on Google Maps was really groundbreaking a few years ago when everyone else, like MapQuest and Yahoo, was the old 1990s style of click the up arrow and then we'll get you a new tile. Click the left arrow, then we'll show you over here. I mean, up until a few months ago, that's what Harvard's map looked like too, but they too have transitioned to what's called an Ajax approach. And if you do this fast enough, if I click and drag, first let me zoom in. If I click, well, now I've got really no interesting earth in this part of the world. So if I click and drag really fast, you might be able to see what's happening at the top left. Briefly, there are little gray squares, and that's because those tiles, those images, haven't been downloaded yet. So what's really going on beneath the hood, underneath the hood here with Google Maps, if I pull up Firebug and go to the net tab, notice every time I click, look at how many requests were just induced. Now, a normal user doesn't throw the map as I just did, because my little clicking and dragging just induced 36 more HTTP requests. And if I zoom in on each of those happens to be a tile, a part of the map. So Google is using JavaScript to programmatically listen for user clicking, user dragging, user letting go. And the moment that happens, they quickly contact the server using HTTP. Turns out with JavaScript, just like PHP, you can make HTTP requests. A response comes back, an image comes back, and voila, that image then gets inserted into the web page. So how can we begin to do things like this? Well, let's take a look. I'm going to go to, let's say, ajax1.html, and I'm going to pull this file up in my browser as well. And notice this. It's a pretty simple website. It's sort of a very primitive version of CS50 Finance. But notice I have a text field here for symbol and then get quote. And if I go ahead and type in something like Goog for Google, click get quote. All right, interesting. It appears that at this moment in time, according to Yahoo Finance, Google stock is worth $617.415. So let me go ahead and see how we did this. Well, first, let's look at the HTML down here. It's actually a pretty simple web page, right? This did not take much effort to write. I've got a body, a form, interesting, an unsubmit handler, and then also return false. So it seems that I'm now using the idea of a form to have a purely client-side experience. The whole page is not going to reload. And this, too, is one of the themes these days with web programming. You might very well still be clicking buttons and checkboxes all the time on websites, but it's increasingly rare that the whole page reloads. Instead, you get like a little progress bar or spinning icon, and then bam, more content appears. Facebook, again, case in point. If you scroll to the bottom of your newsfeed, there's usually like an older posts link. If you click that, it doesn't reload the whole page. It instead just changes, I think, to some kind of progress bar. And then bam, a second or two later, more posts. It's using JavaScript, listening for your mouse click. When it hears it, requesting more data from the server via HTTP, gets back more HTML, and it just adds it into the existing DOM, into the existing tree structure. So how is this happening here? Well, notice I've got an input element. This time I give it an ID. So you can use name and ID for largely similar purposes, but ID is a bit better because it means it has to be unique. So if you know you specifically want that element in a web page to be accessed with JavaScript, if you give it an ID, now you can ensure that when you get that element, you're getting that one and only that one. And then I just have a submit button that looks like this. So the magic must derive from this ID on my input. So let me scroll up here. So there's a bunch of code here, but fortunately, libraries and APIs have made this kind of programming easier, but I'm doing it old school, sort of the low-level way, just so we can see what's really going on. Here is my head tag. And here is a script tag therein. And notice that I'm declaring what appears to be a global variable. Global in the sense that it's not at the top of my file, but it is at the top of my JavaScript code. It's at the top of my script tag. So in that sense, this is a global variable, XHR. And I'm initializing it to null so that it just has some known value. XHR is deliberate because it turns out modern browsers support a special feature in JavaScript called the XML HTTP request object. Kind of a convoluted name, but this is a special object, a special feature of JavaScript that allows you to make HTTP requests, get back the response, and then show them to the user or embed them in the web page. So the magic is ultimately going to derive from this feature of recent years' browsers. So here's my quote function. It's a little, got a little bit of new syntax here. The function called quote first does the following. So this is a feature of JavaScript. PHP supports this as well, as does Java and C++ and other languages. There's this notion in some languages of exceptions. And actually, let's see. Did that have it? Yeah, so we haven't really seen this yet. So in JavaScript, there's this notion of an exception. An exception is a way for a function to say something bad happened without returning some arbitrary value. A lot of C functions return zero if there's a return negative one if there's a problem, or they return some special value if there's a problem. PHP, meanwhile, tends to return false if there's a problem. This is problematic because suppose you're writing a function in C and you want to be able to return a number. Well, unfortunately, if something goes wrong, you can't return a number because maybe that's just the actual answer you're expecting. If the function in C you're writing is supposed to add two numbers together, well, what if the answer of adding 2 plus negative 3 is negative 1? Does that mean an error happened, or does that mean the math was correct? So in short, with C and languages like it, the way that we implement error handling is pretty hackish, right? We return some special value, and we have to check for that with a condition. Now, in languages like JavaScript, you have kind of this back channel for signaling errors, and it's called exception handling. And with this model, what you do is you call a function as usual. In this case, I'm writing a line of code like this. XHR gives me a new XML HTTP request object. This is new syntax for many of you, but for now, just take for granted. Take it for granted that this is what you have to type to get a new object called XML HTTP request. But notice I'm only trying to execute this line of code. So what's happening here is if something goes wrong, like there's no internet connection or the browser's too old to understand this, what's going to happen is this line of code is going to throw an exception, which is like a special variable, special object that represents an error. And someone playfully decided the corresponding syntax would be catch. And so you write code that catches that error to detect that something bad has happened. Now, you won't need to write this much code yourself. In fact, for the AJAX part of any code you write, odds are you can abstract these details away with a library, as you'll see. But for now, just realize this is what this is all about. Now, unfortunately, this is a stupid reality. So as is often the case in the web world, different companies like to do things different ways. And this line of code will fail on older Internet Explorer browsers because Microsoft decided that the syntax would be this instead. So the only reason I have to do this particular try and catch, the only reason lots of websites have to do this these days is, again, because companies don't play nicely on the playground when it comes to coming up with these standards. So we're stuck with writing more lines of code than is ideal. But the point for now is, if at this point in the story that variable is still null, it must be you're browsing my website with like Netscape 1.0 and it just doesn't work. So I'm going to catch that, yell at you, and just return immediately. But that generally does not happen these days. So notice what I do. It's not much code at all. I declare a variable. So in JavaScript, there is a special keyword called var that says, give me a variable. It's not a data type. You just say var x, var y, var URL. And now notice in JavaScript, I assign a variable a value just with the equal sign as usual, equals quote unquote. What's going on here? Well, notice I'm creating a string that starts with quote 1.php, question mark, symbol equals something. So this is my way of constructing a URL and then appending to it some parameters. This is what's also nice about GET. You can construct GET requests on the fly in code because you just have to create a URL, and a URL is just a string. So what am I doing? I'm creating a URL that starts with quote 1.php, question mark, which says here comes the parameters, symbol equals, end quote. And now this is a minor nuisance. In JavaScript, the concatenation operator is plus, whereas in PHP, it's dot. Different philosophies, does the same thing. So this is going to concatenate onto the end of this string what? Document.getElementById, quote unquote, symbols, value. Now again, new function, but it really does what it says. And this is one of the nice things too about JavaScript. Most functions are just named very aptly. GetElementById returns to you the object in memory that represents the symbols input field, and .value, like before, just gets me its specific value. So in the end, if I've typed in Goog, what does this actually do? This creates a variable for me called URL, and it stores in that this string here, quote unquote, that's essentially the end result of this line of code. So now, if I haven't specified http://, and then cloud.cs50.net, that's going to be assumed. Because just like in web pages, you don't have to put URLs in your image tags and in your CSS tags. You can just say a relative URL. So this really is going to mean something like an implied cloud.cs50.net/something. So I don't need all of that mess at the beginning. It's going to be inferred. So what actually happens then? Well, notice with this, three lines of code, I get to do something really powerful. First, I say XHR on ready state change, verbose but clear, will be clear, equals handler. Come back to that in a moment. XHR.open, what method do I want to use? Get, unfortunately in this case it's capitalized, but it's the same thing. What URL do I want to get? And then true is a good thing to put here. It means asynchronous. AJAX means asynchronous JavaScript and XML. This just means don't put up a stupid progress bar or something like that. Just go get it and return the value as soon as you're ready. It's a non-blocking call in computer science speak. And then lastly, send. Now, it doesn't matter so much the specifics for now. What's the high-level takeaway? Those four lines of code together create a URL, then create a connection to the web server, cloud.cs50.net, and then send those parameters. That's it. So it makes an HTTP request. We did the same thing in PHP code. If you've looked through helpers.php, we used a file called file get contents. This function in PHP does exactly what we described here in JavaScript code, and it does it a little more cleanly. But the magic now is this. Notice that I'm saying xhr.onReadyStateChange equals handler. What's neat about JavaScript, and you can actually do this in C, even though we never exercise this power, you can do this in PHP too, you can pass functions around as though they are variables, as though they are pointers. So you can actually pass a function to another function as an argument, or you can assign to a variable the name of a function. So it turns out that handler here is the name of a function that I happen to write down here, and we'll see what it does in a moment. And as this long word kind of suggests, when the state of this special object, XHR, changes, call this function. So in other words, here's the magic of AJAX. You make a request, and you tell the browser which of your functions to call when the answer comes back from the server, whether that's 20 milliseconds later, or 2 seconds later, or even half a minute later. That function's going to get called, and it's going to be passed what the browser gave it. Well, what does this function do? Well, I read in the manual that if the variable called ReadyState equals 4. It's just arbitrary, but I copy-pasted. And if the status from the web server is 200, we've seen earlier today some bad statuses, 401, 404, 403, 500. 200, we never see, because it's good. Anytime you request a page on the web that comes back, a secret number, namely 200, comes back. So now I'm going to do this, alert of xhr.responseText. So a lot of words that just came out of my mouth. But the takeaway is that this function handler got called, and it alerted the user by passing in this value. So what's actually inside of this text here, xhr.responseText, is whatever the web page actually spit out. So what did it spit out? Well, let's mimic this request ourselves. I said that it's going to ask for quote 1.php ?? equals Goog. Well, let's just do that ourselves. I saw a quote 1 in here a moment ago, quote 1.php. Doesn't seem to do anything. But if I add this myself up top, ?? equals Goog, and then hit Enter, it looks like this PHP script I wrote's purpose in life is just to contact Yahoo, get a number, and then spit it out to the screen. So that's where that's coming from. Unfortunately, just using alerts, not all that sexy. But if we look at the second version here, we can do something a little more familiar with a placeholder. Notice that I can instead embed a response right into a web page, slightly more sophisticated. Notice that I can do something like this and get back multiple pieces of information with a sexy little progress bar. All right, there it is. The server's actually not slow if you look at what's going on there. Turns out if you call, where is it, quote 2, turns out if you call sleep 5, it will sleep for 5 seconds. So that's a useful simulation. But let's see where else we can go with this. Let me go to AJAX 4, type in Goog, get quote. That was actually underwhelming since that's a step backwards, but I'll skip that part here and type in Goog here and get quote. So what's actually working here? Well, frankly, I think the sexiest was number 3. So let's just look at this one. So get quote induced this really fancy progress bar that I made or downloaded. So let's see how this thing works. So in Ajax 3, we have the following HTML. HTML is almost the same, but notice what I've done and realize there's many ways I could have done this. I've got a form. I've got an onSubmit handler and a function call returning false. So the form itself doesn't get submitted. My JavaScript kicks in. I've got an input field for symbol. And then notice this. I've got a div whose ID is progress. Then I'm using a CSS trick. Turns out there's a CSS property called display. And if you set it equal to a value of none, it literally does not display that node. So you know what that node actually is. It's this GIF here, please wait.gif. So even though it looks like animation, this is just sort of a 1990s style animated GIF that just always looks like this. So what my code must be doing is that symbol's that progress bar is always there, but by default, it's hidden. So what I'm really doing is this. Inside of my JavaScript code here for version 3, I create the URL as before, but then notice this trick. I get the element by ID of progress. I get its style property, which relates to CSS, specifically its display property, and I change it to quote unquote block, which is ironically the opposite of none. And then in my handler function, which recall is what gets called when this response comes back, I say document.getElementById progress.style.display equals none. So again, using this very simple primitive of manipulating the DOM, a little something that looks like this, I can now control the entirety of the web page. And even though this was a lot, pretty soon and pretty fast for all of us, these are pretty much all of the fundamentals with which your most favorite websites these days are implemented, including Facebook. So anytime you see Facebook's own progress bar, realize, that is an XML HTTP request object. We'll see you on Monday.